I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate on this lovely afternoon. Figuring out the latest medical news can often cause a headache. Study after study comes out about blood pressure, diabetes, cancer, but which ones are actually worth reading about? Thankfully, the Wall Street Journal publishes a research report every other Tuesday, which highlights a handful of the most important and interesting recent studies. Here today to talk about the latest research is Jeremy Singervine, who writes the column. Last week's roundup focused on kidney donation, Parkinson's, and pain, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Mr. Singervine to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I've been promoting this whole segment by talking about sneezing in sunlight, so I think we need to start with that, which is, why do some people sneeze when they walk out into the sun?
Sure. Scientists published a fascinating study that found people who sneeze are about a quarter of the population have this to some degree. You go out in a bright day and you sneeze. Just because of the sunlight, they found that these people tend to have much more active, what's called visual cortices, the part of the brain that receives the visual signals.
So in a sense, it's like someone could pinch me and I might jump, and these people, the visual stimulation is enough to cause a sneeze.
That's right.
How do you find these studies? Where do you go to look for what might be interesting to report on?
Well, there are the kind of the classic journals. They're published in the United States, in England, the New England Journal of Medicine, the British Medical Journal. These I look at every week. There are a range of those. And then I kind of just try to dig around for some of the quirkier ones. There are journals like Gut and,
Which is about, yes, exactly that.
Exactly.
You also write for Slate, and I'm curious about what you choose for the Wall Street Journal. Are you looking at these thinking, well, these are things, you know, where this particular study might lead to a drug, so people who are interested in investing might want to know about this? Or is it really just what you think is interesting that week?
It's mostly what I think is interesting. There's obviously the section I write for is the personal journal, and it's supposed to be to some degree news you can use.
Mm-hmm.
So there is probably skews away from kind of incremental advances in science and more toward kind of getting towards the end of discoveries and interesting findings.
You wrote about kidney donation in this last column, which was a week and a half ago. Tell us a little bit about what this study showed about what happens after you donate a kidney.
Sure. The findings were amazing. They confirm what transplant centers have suspected for a long time, which is that people who give kidneys, even though they're giving up half of the organ pair that does a ton of work filtering blood, regulating blood pressure, people who donate kidneys live just as long as equally healthy people who don't. And it's really speaks to how amazing an organ the kidney is.
Or the whole body, actually.
Entire body, it's true.
Yeah, and you write about how the remaining kidney actually grows bigger.
That's right.
And can filter more blood.
That's right.
So that our kidneys don't work as hard as they need to, and when you only have one, it can take up the slack.
That's right. Scientists in a previous study found that the remaining kidney after donation grows up to a third as large and becomes about 20% to 30% more efficient in its processes.
You also wrote in this last column about an interesting study about smoking and Parkinson's disease. And I know smoking is one of those things that we mostly look at for its negative effects, but this study showed that you're less likely to get Parkinson's if you're, it's not how much you smoke, but the duration, how long you've
That's
smoked.
Right. For about half a century, scientists have observed that people who smoke a lot, who have kind of grand smoking habits, tend to have less of a risk for Parkinson's. But this study was the first to break down whether it was the number of cigarettes you had a day or how long you had been smoking that determined your risk for Parkinson's.
One of my questions, though, after having read it, because it was a study of elderly patients, is could the people who would have gotten Parkinson's died of smoking-related causes before they got to the age of this study, or had they actually really built it so that they could weed that out?
That type of effect is always a risk in scientific studies of any sort, but they did a pretty good job in this study to make sure that we weren't seeing kind of what they call confounding variables, confounding effects that are exactly what you're talking about.
I know smoking in an episode of House, which is where I get most of my medical information, I guess that may not be such a good thing, but this, once he asked a colitis patient to start smoking because smoking and inflammation have been linked, and smoking is supposed to actually help prevent inflammatory diseases.
That's interesting. I haven't seen that episode. I just started watching House. It's very entertaining, but I'm only a few episodes in. But it's true. Several studies in as early as the 80s have found that people who smoke are less likely to get diseases like colitis, inflammatory diseases, irritable bowel syndrome, Crohn's disease. Again, we're not exactly sure why.
Well, that's always a question. And especially when this kind of information is presented, it's like, all right, how does then someone weigh the benefits and the real negatives of a habit like smoking?
Right. There's no question. I don't think any doctor would prescribe, maybe non-TV doctor would prescribe smoking to cure anything. The risk of lung cancer and emphysema and heart disease are so much higher if you're a long-term smoker or a smoker at all. And part of the reason why smoking is so dangerous is the thousands of chemicals that are released from the tobacco. But within those thousands of chemicals, there may be a few that are beneficial.
And that's, are there people that you've seen who are studying exactly what you just said, we don't know why, who are studying the why of this connection with Parkinson's and the connection with inflammatory disease?
Sure. It's difficult because testing this in humans would be incredibly unethical, forcing them to smoke. But they have done studies in animals. They have a few successful findings. One is that it probably is not nicotine that's creating these effects.
But it's one of the other chemicals.
It's one of the other chemicals.
What drew you to this area of journalism and research? How did you begin kind of nosing around in these studies to find the interesting and the quirky?
Sure. I've always been fascinated by medicine. Not enough to go to medical school, but I think that it's kind of another it's like learning another language. You look at these studies, and at first glance, it's to a layperson gibberish, nearly. But I get a kick out of kind of translating it, weeding through, finding what's relevant and what's not.
One of the things you do in this column, which I found very useful, is you present it, and then you also put a caveat. Well, this is what may mean that this may not exactly be what they're saying it is.
Right. And that's aimed at kind of avoiding some of the called PR hype that can come along with science, because no study is perfect. Even the best studies have kind of inevitable flaws. It's just to point that out.
You also look not just at the research that deals with various diseases, but at the researchers themselves. And you pointed out, I think it was in this past column, a study that looked at doctors who dismissed the safety risks of a diabetes drug. They were more likely than skeptical doctors to have financial ties to the drug's manufacturer.
That's right. There still is a drug. It's marketed by GlaxoSmithKline as Avandia. That not so long ago, there was a review paper that looked at a bunch of analyses of this drug, and they found that diabetic patients who were taking this to improve their condition were actually more likely to have heart attacks than patients who weren't on this drug. It caused a big uproar in the scientific community. There were letters and news studies going back and forth. And just recently, researchers at the Mayo Clinic analyzed all of these recent reports and tried to figure out whether financial ties may be responsible for the position the authors were taking.
It is complicated, I would guess, looking at these studies, because some of them are commissioned by the pharmaceutical companies themselves. Some, like this one you're talking about, is the Mayo Clinic, so that's separate from the pharmaceutical companies. How do you parse all of that when you're looking at a study?
Right. In general, journals make very explicit whether or not a researcher has especially financial conflicts of interest, but other forms as well, and they lay those out. In general, the top journals don't allow most researchers with the most egregious conflicts of interest to publish on those topics. But it is, it's always a concern. It's something Congress is dealing with, seems like every month.
In your Slate column, you're also looking at technology. You had a report just this past week about the way that screens are affecting our vision. What did you find out when you looked at that?
That's right. My mother always told me, don't look so close to the screen, watching whether it's TV or the computer.
Get up, walk around. Right. Yes, and as a mother myself, I now do that all the time. Right. Okay, get up and move around. Get off the screens. Yes.
And so what I wanted to look at first, the most serious possible effect was, do these cause nearsightedness, or what they call myopia? And the research so far says no. There have been, in the last few years, some very much more rigorous studies than in the past, and they found that reading, watching TV, playing video games, any sort of what they call near work where you're staring at a screen or a book, in fact, does not cause nearsightedness.
How about with a flashlight under the covers if you're reading your Kindle?
That's interesting. The British Medical Journal not so long ago named that one of the top medical myths, that reading in low light or under your covers or what have you causes nearsightedness. It plainly doesn't.
The other mother bugaboo is going out without a coat when it's cold outside. Are there any studies about that?
I haven't encountered those, but I won't argue with them yet.
Did you find anything else about the way that screens are kind of monopolizing our lives, whether that there are any other potential impacts from being tied to screens?
Sure. Well, it doesn't cause nearsightedness per se, but the screens do have a real effect on our vision, a temporary but real effect on our vision. Anyone can tell you this when they've spent hours staring at a screen. You get kind of a blurry feel and irritated eyes, and those are all documented and quite frequent effects.
A couple of weeks ago, I think you wrote, and I have been promoting this about that too, you wrote about sugar and gratification. What was that study about?
Mm-hmm. Scientists, researchers in this study they randomized a group, and they gave some soda, real soda, and others the placebo version, which would be diet soda. And then they gave them a set of options, whether you'd like, for example, to receive $1 today or $2 tomorrow, these sort of questions that get at how willing are you to delay gratification. And they found that the group that drank soda, the real soda, the sugared soda, was actually able to delay gratification to earn more rewards in the future, better than the diet soda group was.
Why do people undertake studies like this? That's, you know, I hear those things and I think, well, that's interesting, but...
Sure. Delayed gratification is not just about, playing a game in a laboratory. A lot of people have linked it to how often people agree to join 401ks in their company. There's a lot of interest about kind of financial literacy.
So when you get the forms, they should be giving you a lot of sugar in your tea.
Absolutely.
At the same time. And so this was it was looked at as a study of delayed gratification, not so much a study of sugar's effects.
Sure. The interesting part about sugar is it seems like it links into an evolutionary kind of reaction, that when you're low on sugar, your body kind of sends a signal that says, well, we need gratification of some sort now.
And if it's not sugar, it could be a dollar, and that's
sure.
Better than waiting till tomorrow.
Sure.
That's interesting. What have you come across that you've said, this is fascinating, but I'm not sure I should really write about it? Is there anything that you've encountered like that?
This Parkinson's and smoking, you don't want to give people the wrong impression that if you don't want Parkinson's, you should start smoking today. But we trust the readers to be intelligent, and we provide them with enough evidence and information to make intelligent choices.
We have about a minute left. What's ahead for you? Do you have some things on the horizon that you can actually tell us about that
sure,
you think are interesting?
Sure. Nothing's set in stone, but there will be possibly items on drinking and test taking, for example.
Drinking alcoholic.
Alcohol, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
What are some other possible items? Chocolate's effect on cardiovascular disease.
Have you found any of these have changed your own behavior reading these things?
The one kind of overarching lesson or evidence that comes up again and again is that stress, whether it's family stress or work stress, is just plain awful for your health.
Well, thank you so much. I think that's a good lesson for all of us. I've been speaking with Jeremy Singer-Vine. He is the author of a biweekly report on medical issues in the Wall Street Journal, and he also writes for Slate. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.